Welcome, everyone. This is The LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, May 10th, 2008. My name is Marcia Mary Baker. I'm with the Economic Section of the Executive Intelligence Review News Service. And our topic for discussion today, we have three guests with us, is the right to food, battling the British Empire. And the purpose of this battle, you know, is to vanquish the kind of imperial thinking and practices that have been part of the neo-British Empire, which is the World Trade Organization era, which has brought us to this point of a world food crisis. I want to highlight a couple of things, especially that concern Mr. Lyndon LaRouche, who May 7, everyone, gave an international webcast update on the world strategic situation. He called it Tragedy and Hope. And that's available to you, the transcript. We are publishing an EIR news service. And you can see that on his political action committee, LaRouchePAC.com, LaRouchePAC.com. But before I do that, I want to welcome with us from two parts of the world, beginning here in the studio, Mike Billington. Welcome, Mike.
Glad to be here.
And as you may know, Mike is part of the Asia desk of the EIR News Services, traveling, meeting, knowing a lot about that whole part of the world with 3.5 or more billion people. We have from Washington, D.C. here with the LaRouche Youth Movement from the Washington office and bureau. We welcome Michelle Lerner. Hi.
Hello. Thanks.
And thanks for being here. I know it's busy. You're trying to change the world on Capitol Hill. That's tricky. But we are very glad that in the middle of the night or mid-morning, we have from Australia, Glenn Isherwood. Welcome, Glenn.
Hi, Marcia. Good
and
to be here.
Good. So what we're going to discuss is a lot of physical economy of and political battling of how we are going to feed people and meet the right to food. But I'll just say this, as Mr. LaRouche was briefing a meeting earlier today, he said, look, we're at a breaking point since the financial system is gone. I mean, really gone. You're seeing debris flying around the air and falling everywhere. But the breakdown in the economy is manifest in this food shortage crisis and the hyper-speculation. We've had decades of underproduction. And so the breaking point is, are we going to have more British Empire-type policies? Will that prevail, which will mean the darkest kind of dark age? Or will this question of food, which is certainly people are responding to, it's more than close to home, does this partly create the conditions where we can overturn what's brought us to this point once and for all? So I'll just say these two things that anyone listening to this, if you don't know, you know, in April, Mr. LaRouche launched something you can call in shorthand, kill the WTO. Don't reform it. Don't play with it. Don't look for a better deal under the Doha round. Don't ask for subsidies to be eliminated in the so-called rich countries. Don't Dubai, you know, kill the WTO. And Helga Zepp LaRouche, Mr. LaRouche's wife in Germany, and a German patriot and an international leader, has said, let's make the upcoming World Food Summit, which is taking place in Rome, June 3 to 5, hosted by the UN Food and Agriculture Organization. It was called a year ago, this World Food High-Level Conference. But it was called a year ago within the WTO mindset of bioenergy, adjusting to climate change, all this crap, frankly. But let's make that a focus where we shift the world. Let's call for, let's make good on doubling world food production to have enough for all. Let's find a way to meet emergency needs of about a billion of the world's people who don't have enough to eat and the hundreds of millions that are facing starvation. Everyone is looking at the ferocious situation in Myanmar, where the beautiful Irrawaddy Delta, which has produced a lot of the world's rice, is devastated right now. So anyway, keep those two things in mind. Look for those calls. Helga Zepp LaRouche is in particular in her capacity as world leader of the Schiller Institute. They have a website, depending what you know language you're looking at. It's basically schillerinstitute.org. And with that, what we want to start off with is a kind of battle update. Beginning, Mike, would like to turn to you because you Asia includes nations that for at least 5 months or more have in effect been rejecting the World Trade Organization. They haven't turned in their membership cards, but they're breaking with the precepts.
Some. Can I go back a bit, though? I'd like to sort of set the stage for Asia by looking at how the whole WTO mentality came to dominate the world economy. If you remember, in the post-war era, you had the Roosevelt tradition, despite the fact that Roosevelt died. There was a tremendous impulse coming out of him and his vice president, Henry Wallace, on global food development. We had the wonders of the Green Revolution, which saved the world from what could have been destitution in the post-war period. Despite the British operations, this tradition saved India, saved other parts of the world from famine. And the U.S. completely supported this kind of thing, but without going through all the details, we got pulled into an economic morass and got sucked into a British war in Asia, in the Vietnam War. And again, without going through the details, that war was a itself was an attack on the United States by the British. It pulled the U.S. into a British-style colonial insanity. It bankrupted our country. It turned us away from the policy of Roosevelt's commitment to developing the Third World into one of becoming something of a colonial-type power. Of course, we lost the war. When we had lost that war by 72, 73, 74, that era, the problem was great for the British, and they called upon one of their top American assets, Henry Kissinger, to pull together an alternative, and this became known as the National Security Memorandum 200, in which he laid out that American strategic policy, if we were to follow the British, he didn't put it that way, but it was to be that we had to prevent the population growth in the Third World, because these populations would eat up our resources, the resources we in the West need, the Anglo-Americans that we need. And to do so, he laid out quite explicitly that the most important weapon was food, that we had to control both the food aid and limit it in cases where nations refused to accept our dictates, and in fact to discourage food self-sufficiency, food development, whenever possible, in order to continue using food as a weapon, as we also were using energy as a weapon. So here you had the policy laid out in spades, and this is really what then emerged over the last 15, 20 years as a WTO policy. Prevent food development, use control of food and the forced starvation as a as an economic policy, as a political control mechanism. And it didn't work right away. You actually had, in places like the Philippines, under President Marcos, a tremendous application of the American system method of a green revolution, using hybrid grains, using extension, using irrigation, using fertilizers, that turned the Philippines for the first time in its history into a rice exporting nation, became self-sufficient. And similar things going on across the region. So when you see the WTO coming in full in the 1990s and basically forcing nations to adopt what really is just a colonial food weapon policy, this unfortunately has had dire consequences. But as you mentioned, Marcia, it hasn't been something that was foolishly grasped as somehow of benefit to the Third World countries. And there has been a fight, and in the especially now that the food crisis is so apparent, that the famine sweeping across Asia, sweeping across almost the entire globe, is something that cannot be avoided. Nations, even those nations that have been slavishly following the dictates of the IMF and the World Bank and the WTO, are by necessity forced to take, in some cases, very dramatic measures to break from this lunacy and to reassert the necessity of producing self-sufficient quantities of rice, of reaching out for some means of cooperating amongst nations so that the producers cannot be subjected to the control of the speculators in London, but can begin to assert their own power in order to keep nations alive, keep nations afloat.
Could you review a couple of those? I mean, just run the kinds of measures. India put limitations on certain kind of export of rice. otherwise the new announcements to become self-sufficient by Malaysia and Philippines?
Yes, the Malaysian and Philippines have both declared that they have been foolish. They don't say that about themselves, but it's as much as to admit it, that they've been foolish to allow themselves to not be self-sufficient in their agriculture, and have launched emergency programs with significant amounts of money, with support from the International Rice Research Institute, one of those institutes that came out of the Roosevelt tradition, which happens to be located in the Philippines but is international in its scope, and collaborating also with the Chinese. The Chinese, of course, recognize that their ability to sustain this, the largest country in the world, depends absolutely on their capacity to maintain especially their food supply to their population. And I think it's worth mentioning here that a year and a half ago, in December of 2006, the head of the International Rice Research Institute, Robert Ziegler, an American doctor who is now head of this great institute, traveled to Washington with the explicit purpose of warning the Americans. Remember, this is a year and a half ago, long before the so-called food crisis that we're now hearing about was even, you know, hinted at in official media and government circles. He came here to warn America that we were facing the greatest famine in history in Asia, that China and India in particular were already facing the threat of vast famine, and that they were already suffering from extreme malnutrition, stunting, and so forth as a result of the breakdown of stockpiling of rice, of the breakdown of the financing of the kind of research required at places like the IRRI to constantly increase the types of high-yield grains necessary to sustain growing populations, and the rice spike. A price spike, there you go, which was already beginning. And he warned that if there were not emergency measures taken, that we would be facing this kind of a dire crisis. And, in fact, he wasn't even thinking about the financial speculation that was setting in around the world. He wasn't even referencing necessarily the insane ethanol destruction and burning of food, simply from the long-term policy of the WTO of discouraging production in favor of making nations depend upon trade, with the net result being that there was a net decrease in food production per capita over an extended period of time, threatening this kind of destitution. So this has been known for a good long time. The nations are now taking the kinds of measures you just indicated. Whether or not it's going to be soon enough is very much in doubt. These are countries which may or may not be able to implement the kind of emergency measures fast enough, which there's no local solution in any one of these cases. There are measures that can be taken as emergency measures, but even in the medium term, if there is not a global push for doing away with the WTO, calling on a global policy led by the United States and by our allies in Russia and China and India, to implement this kind of emergency global economic program with a focus on the food, then we are looking at, in fact, the breakout of famine and the kind of social explosions that can blow up countries very, very rapidly, not only through food riots, but through general social dislocations.
Well, let's pursue. There are many ways we could go here, but one thing you mentioned in passing, that this gentleman, Dr. Robert Ziegler from the International Rice Institute, that was December 2006, even sometime before that, Lyndon LaRouche, the LaRouche Youth Movement, created a storm in Washington, D.C. about the killer nature of biofoolery. In fact, it was June 2006. There was a white paper circulated in Washington that this would lead to food shocks and, beyond food shocks, famine. And meantime, some of the congressmen were riding around in cars with big ears of corn painted along the side, going right along with what was clearly what has since been called a crime against humanity to put food in your tank instead of on your table. But it's maybe Johnny come lately. But are there some signs of life, Michelle? You are right there in Washington. I don't know where you were in June 2006. But you've been there this week when certain indications of, you know, back against the wall appreciation of the food crisis have shown up, right?
Yeah, well, there was just recently I mean, I guess this is a small step, but the bill was, or the resolution was introduced that acknowledged the diversion of land for the use of biofuels as one of the components, one of the factors of the increasing price of food. This is a resolution that is actually calling for a world forum on the food crisis. There's also, at the same time, I have to say, there's also been a number of events where people are coming out and trying to still defend the biofoolery for really no real reason. Actually, it's probably the reason is because they're just afraid that they're going to be crushed by the financial system as it is. For instance, one of the arguments made is that the price of oil is a large contributing factor for the price of food. While that may be true, that in certainly in no way leads to the argument, as some are trying to make, that biofuels are going to contribute to solving this crisis. In fact, it'll tend to make it worse. The only real solution is to go with a real infrastructure program. So there, we get things on both sides, but now there is the fact that they have to defend it in this way shows that the discussion is being provoked and a number of people are starting to come around to the conclusion that this type of insanity has to stop and we have to look at what really is going on. And what's going on right now is massive starvation. And so there is a potential quality of change that is starting to develop here. We'll just have to see what direction it leads in.
Good. I can throw in here, please add more, but in your reports from Washington in the last 24 hours, I understand that a small step towards change, what you're saying, at least towards acknowledgement, is next Wednesday. We're speaking May 10, so that would be May 14 in the morning. There is a hearing on the food crisis in the Senate chaired by Joe Biden of the, I think, Foreign Relations Committee, and in the House, Barney Franks, his committee, which hasn't been distinguishing itself at all. But there are people being called to testify nominally, at least on Capitol Hill, from the State Department's Agency for International Development and from the World Food Program. Is that right, Michelle?
That's right. The particular resolution was actually introduced into the Foreign Affairs Committee, which is the one that's holding this hearing. And I think I'm not sure of the number, but I think a number of the co-sponsors of the sponsor is on the committee. And I think a number of the co-sponsors are also on the committee as well. I think the number of co-sponsors is up to 50 now. So there is some signs of life. On the issue of the Financial Services Committee, given the performance that they've been that they've had over the past several months, past 9 months or so, I don't know what to say about that. I'm somewhat shocked, but I guess we'll just have to see.
Well, I think maybe you indicated it, that it certainly represents they have to they may be on the defensive, but this is so mammoth. I'll just throw in here, I mean, the crisis of literally not having food. Just look at what's required for the people that have been growing rice in the Indo-Chinese Peninsula in Myanmar, in the Irrawaddy system there. I mean, now they need the food that they otherwise were growing. So in that score, if you take a rough calculation internationally of the effort by farmers to grow corn or even wheat up in Canada, which is awful, or Glenn may tell us they're using some wheat or something for ethanol in Australia, but if you take all the ethanol refineries in the world and the food they're sucking into them, this might represent enough food for close to 400 millions of people. It's tricky how to calculate it. You have sugar cane in Brazil. You have other things that go into ethanol. But there are 400 million people. This is half of all the people that are really every day we know are going hungry and in desperate need. So whatever Barney Frank thinks he is or ain't going to do, I think it's quite an impressive situation. Do you find people on the street in Washington, Michelle, or what you hear about elsewhere in the country, is anyone responding outside of these go-along types?
Well, the approach that we've been taking is to completely ridicule Al Gore and showing people that he is the cause of the food crisis, perhaps because he's eating all the food as well. A number of people are getting a real kick out of that. There's less and less people that come to the defense of Al Gore these days. There are some around, but there's less and less in comparison to those who help, who join in the ridiculing. So...
I hear he got a lot of ridicule when his book came out in Malaysia and Philippines and Indonesia 2 years ago. They said he has about as much as a journalist said, Al Gore visited Singapore or somewhere. He has about as much charisma as a moose head on the wall. But Glenn, then from Australia, this is a rethink for all the Australians that used to be the paragon of food production, unfortunately used by the British Empire types as, you know, for sourcing their internationally controlled food. But now we need Australia's food, and yet the capacity has been beaten into the ground, right? What are people thinking?
Well, yeah, for us in Australia, it comes down to a question of a moral question. In the fact that for Australia, it's a question of acting on a principle of the advantage of the other. And unfortunately, the problem here in Australia has been that there's been a systematic attack on our farming and agricultural capabilities coming from Britain, and we've been documenting this over the last months and seeing how they're turning up the heat to destroy the Australian agricultural production abilities here. And I think it's important to put it on stress the importance of acting for the advantage of the other, because this is effectively what we're calling on nations to do. What we've been organizing around here just lately is I was with a team of the LaRouche Youth Movement that just went recently to Sydney to organize around stopping one of the latest of a round of attempted privatizations in the state of New South Wales. The Premier there, as well as the Prime Minister, the new Prime Minister of Australia, Kevin Rudd, basically come from that liberal, I mean, ironic, he's part of the Labor Party, but the policies adopted by both the major parties here has been rabid free trade, rabid privatizations. And most of these politicians here are bought and paid for by the financial interest represented by banks like that British bank, Macquarie. And when we mention the bank like Macquarie, we know what we're dealing with. I mean, you have them running around Washington, D.C., putting tolls on our roads, and infrastructure and other things. Effectively, essentially what we've got here in Australia going on at the moment is a grab for private control of infrastructure, and what this includes is water. A few months back we put out a pretty extensive report that the most productive agricultural region of Australia, the Murray-Darling Basin, the water allocation and the water on this land was effectively taken out of the hands of the population or the farmers that owned that land and was turned into a commodity which the Australian government, top-down, was grabbing up.
Glenn, just let me interpose here. People should have a mental picture of Australia. I can't help it, but a little geography to underscore what you're saying. If you picture the whole big continent of Australia, the desert and everything you hear so much about is in the central and western parts, but down in the southeast is this wonderful runoff of these two systems in a huge area, the Murray River and the Darling River, right? That has, you can describe its how important and what a big place, how much you've been able to grow there over decades, right? And then continue.
Just to capture the agricultural potential that we have here, I found a figure. There was a reported figure recently thrown out that in 2001, the Australian Murray-Darling was producing 1.75 million metric tons of rice, and most of that went to export. And that was its, and 7 years later, in 2008, the forecast is that this year we'll produce just a measly 20,000 tons of rice. And you have a situation where we went from being one of the largest producers of rice in the world, I'm sure that puts us in the top six, back in 2001, you have a situation where that's effectively gone to zero. And the question to ask is, how did that happen? How did we go from being a huge... the other report is that our rice production is known to be the most cost-effective, efficient for water, and has the most fertile and productive land for rice cultivation in the world. And what's happened is... systematically, the water allocation and the availability for fresh water to our farmers in this region has been, put the drought. We've had a condition of drought for about a decade. But on top of that, there has been a deliberate policy through the government acting for the interest of the British free trade policies not to develop infrastructure. Not to develop the huge amounts of infrastructure water projects that could actually supply the irrigation in this region to make this a breadbasket for the world. And the Murray-Darling Basin is the breadbasket for Australia. It produces 80% of our own food, and a huge amount of our exports come from that region. And the reason for this was because of Australia's adoption of the methods of building mass infrastructure, like the Snowy River Scheme, which was inspired through the ability to fund such projects, came through our modeling the financing of the American policies of Roosevelt, and even earlier, the methods of Hamilton in financing it through public credit. And what's happened is essentially the parties and the politicians here have now become a bunch of bought and paid for stooges for the banking and financial cartels typified by these banks like Macquarie, who are trying to turn water into a commodity.
Right, and the way they're doing it, by the way, they're analogous. Other precious agriculture centers of the world where that's been happening, like the lower Colorado River that feeds the Imperial Valley, where in recent years, and Duncan Hunter is one of the congressmen who was involved in that, the water was monetized or commoditized or whatever you call it, so that it could be sold for urban residential use in San Diego or something like that, when in fact San Diego's on the Pacific. You could desalinate billions of gallons of water. You don't need to do it. But so you still have a fight on your hands that you've been waging all along on this, I take it, Glenn.
Yes, well, we have a challenge here in Australia is we've got a heavy and thick British ideology owing to the fact that we have yet to break from the British Commonwealth. And what this... one of the big problems we have is this problem of having a anti-science and anti-technology environmentalist ideology that is widespread, where I mean, one of the things that has contributed greatly to the lack of water coming to our farmers is that we've actually taken water that used to be flowing through our rivers, and we've diverted this water for natural environmental flows. And the what's incredible about these groups that have advocated this is that in the Murray-Darling, before the infrastructure was built, the rivers ran dry. But since these rivers have been built, they insist upon the rivers always running as in its natural state. And so with these ludicrous policies, effectively there's been, on top of the drought, a environmental push to prevent water coming to our farmers and to go into other areas. So one of the big fights for us is it's a big challenge to get back to the policies of infrastructure building to increase the available water supply for our farmers in this region and also other parts of the country. I mean, it's a situation where Australia has a need to go for desalination projects in other parts of the country where we don't have conditions like the Murray-Darling Basin, but other parts we need desalination. And it's a very interesting fact that Australia is, in terms of resources and material resources, we have the greatest deposits of uranium and thorium in the world, and we don't actually have a current functional nuclear power plant anywhere in the country that provides energy. So this has been created by the environmentalist movement, funded and heavily funded by the British financier cartels of Prince Philip. I think it's worth noting here that the same people that set up this anti-technology and anti-science movement, which is the other element of the problem, were financed by Malthusians and genocidalists like Prince Philip, and we've already mentioned Fat Al Gore. But this is going to be the challenge for us. Is as I stated at the outset, it's a morality question. We need to be prepared to scrap these failed policies for the sake of the advantage of the other. And in Asia, there's a lot of in the Myanmar case where the rice production has been severely affected, as well as elsewhere. We could do so much in the short term, medium, and long term to actually help our neighbors, which is the real fight for us.
Let me say something on the Myanmar thing, which I'm sure everybody is thinking about. And I want to discuss a little bit this call for a organization of rice exporting nations. But and that reflects on what's happening in Myanmar. But as everybody knows from watching TV and the newspapers and so forth, this has been a devastating cyclone. It's wiped out probably about 40% of their rice land, a nation which used to provide rice for most of the British Empire back in the British imperial days, but have been so isolated, broken down, targeted, sanctioned, and so forth, that their ability to sustain rice has been reduced pretty much to their own self-sustaining capacity and some small export capacity. That's now gone. But it's very important for people to see what's happening in the media. There is a massive effort to use this tragedy as a basis for implementing an extension of the British regime change psychology, the colonial policy which we saw so brutally imposed by Cheney and company in Iraq, and is now being threatened against a whole series of nations in Central Asia, in Southwest Asia. But that this is literally a case, and you'll see this openly, in U.S. officials, in the French Foreign Minister Kouchner and others, are saying, we think that the Burmese, by not allowing in the U.S. military to take charge of the distribution of food supplies for these people destroyed by the cyclone, show that they don't care about their population. And since this is an attack on the character of the United Nations, that you have to take care of your people, this is a justification for us to invade Myanmar, in order to help their people. Now, this is, first of all, it's factually just a crock. It's absolute garbage. There has been food pouring into that country from their real friends, India, Thailand, China, from the moment the cyclone hit. They already have dozens and dozens of international institutions present within Myanmar who had material stockpiled and are getting it out in a very rapid fashion, in a responsible fashion. Yes, of course we could use the American helicopters, but keep in mind, this is a nation which has been threatened with regime change by Condi Rice, by George Bush, by George Bush's wife. This is a nation openly threatened with military attack. And to say, sure, bring in your helicopters is not exactly something you're going to do lightly. But more importantly, the lie going out that somehow this nation is allowing everybody to die is absolute fraudulent and is being used to justify what could actually be an extension of this regime change, basically fascist policy coming out of the British. It's not likely to happen. The Chinese and the Indians and so forth are not about to let that happen. But it's a threat which has to be watched, because at this point in the breakdown of the world financial system, we are watching the British and their allies within the U.S. and so forth on a push for warfare which throws all concerns about the consequences aside and says, we have very little time, our financial system is gone, we've lost our chance, we've almost lost our chance, we have to go to war now, certainly in Southwest Asia, which is what's being threatened with this breakout of crisis in Lebanon, Syria, and possibly Iran in the next days and weeks, and that we have to look at this kind of a threat in Myanmar, like the threat to China over the Tibet issue, as issues that can be transformed into war-justifying policies virtually overnight. So I think that's important, just to put on the table, that people think about this as they watch these lies being peddled in the world media. It's important that even some sane people here in the U.S. are saying that this is ridiculous. Robert Gates, our defense secretary, when asked about this, said ridiculous, that we're not going to do anything without the approval of the Myanmar government. So it's only the crazies that are doing it, but unfortunately the crazies out of London and their allies in the Cheney crowd are capable of virtually anything at this point. Now, I want to take a minute to describe this Organization of Rice Exporting Nations. It's being denounced. The British are screaming bloody murder. Oh, my God, another OPEC. They're going to take control of food and starve us all to death, and so on and so forth. This, again, is just an absolute crock. These nations, there's two different groups actually being brought together. One is a brand new thing called the Organization of Rice Exporting Nations, which is Thailand and Vietnam. These are the two biggest exporters in the world. And the poor countries that surround Thailand, Laos, Cambodia, and Myanmar, Burma, which are potentially huge rice producers and rice exporters. But the purpose of OPEC is twofold, or OREC, is twofold. The explicit stated purpose is that these nations recognize that the main reason they're not getting huge amounts of rice exports out of Cambodia, Laos, and Myanmar is that they have a dire lack of infrastructure. You can't just produce huge amounts of food. Even if you had a Green Revolution program to use hybrids and high-yield grains, you still couldn't get the food to market. Like in Cambodia, the food is largely produced in the northern part, and they literally cannot get it to the ports in the south. And therefore, a lot of their food is just sold cheap over the borders into Thailand and Vietnam, who then sell their rice at a much higher price and eat the cheaper rice coming from Cambodia. Well, this is foolish, you know. If you could get the rice to market, if you had the roads and the railroads and the transportation capacity and the storage capacity so that the rice doesn't rot after it's milled and so forth, then that kind of technological input would transform these regions. The Thais, for instance, are building dams along the Salween River, much to the disgust of the World Wildlife Fund that wants to make sure that the vampire bats have their habitat. But they don't want dams. They don't want people using water for something productive. But, of course, if you had these dams, some of them would be used to expand the irrigation capacity in Myanmar and greatly improve their rice production capacity. So that's the purpose of OREC. The second purpose is, as I briefly mentioned before, the British are screaming about this because they're trying to take control over the price of grain. Well, yes, indeed they are, because at this point the price of grain has very little to do with the supply and demand problems, and everything to do with the fact that the central banks of England and Europe and the United States are pumping literally trillions of dollars into the banking system, trying to hold them afloat while they're collapsing. And that money has nowhere to go productive. It's going into speculation. So that for the first time in recent history, we have huge amounts of speculation going into the commodity exchanges on food, driving up these prices, in a period where you do, in fact, have shortages as well, so that you literally reach these hyperinflationary increases that are going on virtually overnight in every major grain. And therefore, they said, let's get together, let's form a group of producers so that we can make sure that there are supplies made available to other countries in Africa and other parts of the world who desperately need this grain, who don't have to go through these world cartel markets. This, of course, is what the British despise. This is what they hate. This is the kind of act of sovereignty amongst sovereign nations who join their sovereign forces in order to help other sovereign nations in the tradition of the Peace of Westphalia, what Glenn identified as the interest of the other, as being in their self-interest. And so this is what is taking place, and I'll just briefly mention, I learned this morning, that a group that was brought together some time ago but hasn't met in the last 6 years of the five largest producers, which is China, India, Pakistan, Thailand, and Vietnam, a group which has a name I wasn't familiar with. It's called the Council on Rice Trade Cooperation. But they have just announced this morning that they're going to reconstitute themselves and have some sort of emergency meeting in the next month. So these are people who recognize that if we leave the food crisis in the hands of the WTO, of the oligarchs, of the speculators, then we are dying. We will die. And therefore, we and our allies around the world will die. And that this is the cutting edge of a fight against the colonialism, which is now known as globalization, but which is nothing but colonialism, being fought by those nations who are reaching back into their own history and beginning to recognize that this is a time where nations have to assert a sense of sovereignty and in league with those around the world who have the fate of mankind in their hearts to join forces in the kind of call which we've made. And we are certainly committed to getting as many of these nations as possible, directly collaborating with Helga LaRouche and Lynn LaRouche on this call for doubling food production, ending the WTO, getting the New World Economic Order.
Yes, and just 1 second. Technically, we want to check that our connection to Australia is still intact. Glenn, could you say okay.
I'm here. Yeah.
Okay, good. You may have heard a few things on the line. Great. Well, let me ask you this, although Glenn may interpose something else and so forth in the remaining 17 minutes or so, but back to Michelle, you're still with us in Washington, right?
Yeah.
It's so clear, people need food, they should eat, and all of these challenges, the exciting job of restoring and building anew capacity to feed people, it's terrific in physical economic terms. But back to ridiculing Al Gore, if you use signs, if you use songs, if you use anything, what do you find on this long time brainwashing about environmentalism and back to nature BS, all that really what amounts to green fascism, where do you find that's cracking here in the United States? Do you think so? Or is it just humor and then get people starting to think?
It's a little hard to say as of right now because I think the situation, the collapse of the financial system has really been accelerating at an amazing rate. As LaRouche has pointed out, in these types of situations, you see an acceleration of the rate of acceleration. And I think that is, for the most part, leaving people with a lack of understanding of what has caused it or what can be done. So I think the population is very open, But at the same time, because there hasn't been because there hasn't really been an emphasis on what the real history of the nation is, there's a necessity for education. There's a necessity for a lot of education, and that's always a process that takes a bit of time to really work through. At the same time, because of the severity of the crisis, I think that that can be accomplished very rapidly as well. So at this point, it's a little bit difficult to say what types of changes may be occurring in the population, but what we do know is that regardless of any of that, our job is to educate people on what the solution is and how to prevent this type of disaster from occurring repeatedly in the future once we get through this one.
Michelle and Glenn, how do you see, have you mapped out how you want to get the Helga's call for doubling food and wiping out the WTO and getting the new world, the new Bretton Woods? Do you have a plan for getting this out into the political leadership and into the population?
We're in the process of drawing up some plans on which institutions to go to really engage in joining this fight. One thing it's very clear is that it's clear what policies need to be repealed and what policies need to be put in place in the short term. Like as Marsh had said, that just by ceasing the biofoolery, we can make available huge amounts of food to feed millions. What we plan to do is we have a large regional support base in Australia. Our organization down here, the LaRouche Movement, the support for our organization comes through the farming and agriculture sectors more than any other. And essentially, they have the greatest conscious recognition that this economy has been collapsing. So with our support base, we plan to get out there and, in this fight, activate as many of our supporters to become actual on-the-ground troops in a actual war against the British, to get them to organize their families, their communities, to actually, and also to make endorsements and submissions to in support of what Helga's calling for internationally. And there's also some notable engineers and veterans of the industries here, like that have built. That were involved in building up the infrastructure and these water projects, who have some ideas that can be shared on how to increase the food production through methods of irrigation and others. Like one notable figure in that is an engineer called Lance Endersby here, who has in the past called has made many. Has addressed many audiences on the infrastructure potential and projects that we can launch immediately to boost food production in the Australian region, but also Southeast Asia and elsewhere. So we're planning to use these resources and get in touch with them as well as the political layers across the country.
Right. And Michelle, are you mapping out or strategizing as well, I guess? Do you want to say anything about that, or we can presume?
Well, to begin with, at this hearing, well, we have the EIR. The most recent issue of the EIR does have that call within it. And that's something we've been distributing in Washington, D.C. That was something that was distributed at the press conference where this resolution was brought up, as well as the fact that what we're planning, what we've been doing is contacting the Foreign Affairs Committee, there's been a little bit of work with the with the Agriculture Committee as well, we've also been contacting the co-sponsors of the resolution to begin a process of discussion. There's several layers of government in Washington, D.C. So we've started with the Congress, but I'm sure there's plenty other layers to get this to. There's the Agricultural Department as well is something that we have right here that you can easily access and circulate this call to as well. So there's just a lot of work that needs to be done as of now.
Yeah, great. Let me give a couple of examples from Asia, which point to the fact that what Lynn has been saying about this food crisis, which is that it's not just food. This is the idea of economics itself, that the food crisis is going to force people to recognize that economics is physical, that it's not monetary policy, it's not money. It's about physical goods and about how the human mind develops ideas which are transformed into technological advances, which are then expanded through society and increase the potential relative population density of mankind. This is what makes human beings human rather than animals. So in this crisis, people are going to be driven to begin rethinking how they think about the economy of the human race. I'll give you two quick examples. The head of our organization in Malaysia, Mohammed Peter Davis, who is himself a British-born biochemist, a scientist, who has spent, by the way, 20 years in Australia working on animal husbandry and other kinds of agricultural technologies, but has spent the last 19 years in Malaysia, where he is now basically heading LaRouche's organization there. And he and some of his collaborators have for many years been warning about the fact that Malaysia, as a small country, thought it didn't really need to be self-sufficient. It allowed itself to only produce about 40 or 50% of the grains and other things that it needs, that it could depend on trade. And he warned that this was going to be a disaster. He worked on developing some very, very unique capacities for expanding animal production in the tropics, where normally it's very difficult to raise animals because of the heat. But using the tremendous amounts of water in these deep tropical forests, the ability to grow grass very rapidly, they developed a means for producing a kind of grass and keeping animals in sheds that are cooled, that they could actually rapidly create a great industry in Malaysia, which could be expanded then to other deep tropical countries. And this is something which nobody would pay any attention to. All of a sudden, people are paying a great deal of attention to. And he's also focusing on the fact that to have this kind of water in nations where you don't naturally have the water, we need nuclear power. So he's making the connection where we have some very good friends in Malaysia who have also always wanted to go nuclear but couldn't sort of get the popular support for it. So now all of a sudden there is enormous popular support for this. The government of Prime Minister Abdullah Badawi is opening up new rice land in Sarawak. He is thinking about other ideas where this is opening up to us. And similarly in the Philippines, where we've worked closely with some of the people who were in the agricultural sector recently, who were driven out because of huge corruption problems and so on, but who were committed, a former agriculture minister, Cito Lorenzo, who is partially interviewed in the upcoming EIR, who revived the old Marcos Green Revolution policy to a great extent, working with the Chinese in the years of 2002 to 2004, the Chinese who have developed some very profound hybrid techniques and had put the country on a decent course. This was largely wiped out over the last 6 years, 4 to 6 years. But now, because of this crisis, all of a sudden this government that turned their back on these ideas is thrusting ahead, at least in their rhetoric, with the idea of a crash program for rice self-sufficiency. And not surprisingly, our LaRouche organization, the LaRouche Youth Movement in the Philippines and the LaRouche Society in the Philippines under Butch Valdez, have suddenly been granted a request that they've been making for years to get a formal tour of the Bataan nuclear plant, which has been many people might know, was shut down when Marcos was thrown out of power, but is still there and could be rebuilt and turned on. And they're now going to be going up next Thursday for a tour. And by the way, one of our U.S.-based LaRouche youth members, Lagaya Romanos, Rabolis, is there in the Philippines visiting her family and will be actually joining that tour of this nuclear facility next Thursday. So the idea of science-based economics is wide open. This food crisis is a horrible disaster, but the reason Lynn used the tragedy and hope is that such tragedies force human beings to think like human beings, to stop sitting back and thinking like animals that somehow things will be taken care of for them, and they start using the creative powers of their minds. This is opens them up to the kinds of ideas, Michelle, we're talking about in terms of education. And this is our opportunity to go.
Thank you. And people, look for this call again that Helga Zepp LaRouche gave for the Schiller Institute on doubling farm production, stopping the mortal threat of famine. The Executive Intelligence Review is May 9th, 2008. It's volume 35, number 19, where you can get that online at laRouchePub.com, where you're listening to us right now. And otherwise, you can find the whole initiative and LaRouche's initiative in particular to kill the WTO on LaRouchePAC.com. And also, if we have not done so yet, I must, maybe I'm dreaming, the particular lead fight in Australia of this terrible takedown and privatizing of water in the Murray-Darling Basin. We'll be putting that in Executive Intelligence Review soon. I thought we did so already, but please look for these. Go ahead, Glenn.
I think that there's many facets to the way that the British have taken down Australia's agricultural industry, and it's totally mixed in with the same circles that have been trying for years and years to remove the LaRouche influence on policy in the country, because I think it's just crucial to reemphasize here at the end that right now what we're seeing is there's a growing recognition of a physical economic collapse in every part of the world, and many people can acknowledge the problem, but not a lot of people can present substantial concrete ways of actually solving this food crisis and solving the debt crisis, the foreclosure problems. And this is adding to the desperation of our enemies, the British Empire in Southeast Asia, Australia, the United States. And so I think what's going to appear in EIR is a look at how these circles who have basically created this food shortage through the WTO and others are basically trying to prevent the types of sane solutions that LaRouche has been calling for, and more people are now beginning to hear and become receptive to, because the fantasies and the false beliefs that they held are right now crumbling.
Right. I think you're referring specifically. There is an article written on this. May 16 is the issue, cover date of the printed magazine, but otherwise it will be available by May 13th, posted on EIR online.
But in particular, they're trying to literally knock out your organization there in Australia. They don't want the organization to exist because they know that it's, what you said, the only institution that has solutions.
It's because there's a clear absence of actual grassroots support for any of the major parties here.
Yeah.
Because they don't organize the population. They've become marionettes, puppets on a stage for, as has been widely recognized by many, the private finance and the private forces like Macquarie and others. That's what they are. And if in a time like this you have ideas, you're going to get people hearing these proposals, and that's not good for them.
That's great. In fact, there's a Cranes of Ibicus sense of all of this. Australia was used in the last 25 years as a leading part by the London forces in free trade of what they called the Cairns Group, to say we're going to have totally borderless trade, meaning totally cartel-controlled trade, and that Australia farmers show how this can be done. They are so competitive. In fact, the suicide rate among farmers in Australia has been terrible in this depression. But now, with what you're saying, we're going to be leading the charge instead to reverse this and feed the world. Mm. So
exactly.
And that may make all the difference in Washington, right?
yeah, I would say so.
All right. And so what I'll do, our time has left, but I encourage everyone to answer the call to just pound and hammer the Capitol Hill, but also the Food and Agriculture Organization June 3rd through 5th conference, issue statements, raise the roof. And so this will be the end of our discussion, May 10th, 2008. And I thank Michelle Lerner and Glenn Isherwood and Mike Billington, and ask you all to stay tuned again for the LaRouche Show May 17th, and go to larouchepack.com to see Lyndon LaRouche's Tragedy and Hope World presentation for May 7th. Thank you all very much.
Thanks, Marcia.
Thank you.